Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for info, merchandise and to access the first 33 episodes. Episode 34 onwards can be found exclusively on Hearthfire Radio. Welcome, friends, to the Resurrected Fergan podcast, Back from the Dead. I am your host, Dan Capp, and I'm very, very pleased to be speaking with you again after a lengthy hiatus, wherein the Fergan podcast took a break. And I've been very busy during that time, mostly with musical pursuits, but also family and work, you know, the usual stuff. As you'll know, by virtue of listening to this on the platform that you find it on, which is Hearthfire Radio, this is now where the Fergan podcast finds its home, and I'm very proud and pleased to be associated with the good folks at Hearthfire Radio, with so many exemplary new podcasts, with hosts whom I admire and who I hope to be learning from in the future too. So thank you for being a part of Hearthfire Radio in its early days. Thank you for supporting it, and I really hope that you all get behind this endeavour and make it into the wonderful heathen resource that it can and will be with our collective efforts. My intention is to bring you at least one podcast per month, possibly two. I'm working on that at the moment. I might do some kind of secondary podcast, maybe with a different name, we'll see. I aim to reach the same standards and the same level of effort that went into the first 33 episodes of the Fergan podcast, which you can find in the archives of Hearthfire Radio. So, for those of you who are unaware of what the Fergan podcast is or was about, or I, myself, I'll just offer a brief intro. You'll probably find that of all of the podcasts on Hearthfire Radio, that the Fergan podcast will be one of the more esoteric here. I am a heathen, I'm a practicing heathen, and I have a great respect for the source material that we have, the Elder Edda, the sagas, the other sources that we have, and of course all of the combined folklore and mythology that makes up the Germanic and wider Indo-European lore. However, I am myself prone to a bit of UPG, which, for those of you who don't know, stands for Unverified Personal Gnosis. What I enjoy, and I think perhaps what one of my strengths is to interpret our heathen Indo-European lore in a modern context so that we can make use of it, rather than viewing it as a historic time capsule of events and stories written long ago. My aim is to apply them to our modern lives and to expand upon them, to look at where aspects of our modern experience tie into the wisdom of our ancestors. So that, in combination with a general air of dissidence, particularly in light of what's been happening over the last four and a half years since spring of 2020, the so-called pandemic that I shan't even bother to name, was one of the catalysts for the beginning of the Fergan Telegram channel, which then developed into the Fergan podcast. So I tie all of this together. I believe that heathenry can offer us a sense of salvation, of hope, of kinship, of meaning and purpose in these very, very trying times that we're going through. So that's what you'll find when you listen to the Fergan podcast, and hopefully you find it interesting. I don't expect anyone to agree with all of my theories, speculations, ideas, thoughts. I don't expect that. I just hope that you find it interesting and that it gives you food for thought. I don't mind criticism. And in fact, this episode, which I'll introduce in a moment, is a good example of an episode where I would very much welcome some feedback, because we are going to be talking about giants. So Fergan, for those of you who don't know, is an old English word which on one level means a wooded hilltop. So I, with my musical act, Walkensman, the first album I made was called Songs from the Fergan, Songs from the Wooded Hilltop. And when I was looking for a name for my Telegram channel, which became the podcast, the Fergan seemed like a good one, because what my general philosophy is in the modern age is that we should be detaching, that we should be returning to nature, that we should be almost like, you know, the Robin Hood's band of merry men retreating to the woodland and seeking to live a life in tune with nature, away from the madness of modern man-made laws and customs, which are truly insane. So that's where the Fergan name came from. However, there is another meaning for the name Fergan. Fergan is the Old English cognate of the Norse word Fjörgen. Fjörgen is attested to be the name of Thor's mother. Also, most scholars, most researchers consider Fjörgen to be another name for Jord, which is the embodied earth, also Thor or Thunor's mother. So in some ways, this first podcast back after the hiatus it's a very fitting subject for this, because we're actually getting to the very heart of what a Fjörgen is, because Thor's mother, Fjörgen or Jord, is mostly attested to be a giantess herself. So who or what are the giants? Why should we care? What does it mean that our gods are part descended from the giants? Why does Thor battle with the giants, defending Midgard and mankind? Well, I have a very good reason for wanting to cover this topic, and I don't do so from a kind of LARPy perspective, wherein we are simply viewing the giants as characters from some historical, mythological source, who have no real bearing, you know, just a curiosity from our ancestral past. No, I believe in heathenry as a living tradition, which means that the giants, or Jotnar, or Thursar, or Ettins, or trolls, I believe that they continue to impact upon not only the gods, but our realm, Midgard, and indeed ourselves. So in some ways, we could say, well, what more important topic is there for us in this modern age to be addressing than who is our enemy? Of course, we have human enemies, we have human opponents, we have disagreements with other people, but above all of them, our most powerful and dangerous adversary are what are commonly called the giants. So it behooves us to learn about them, to know who they are. And I'm not going to claim to answer those questions thoroughly in this episode. Indeed, I have a feeling that this may end up having to be part one of a two-part or even more series, because in researching for this episode, and I have conducted quite a bit of research, as I said, I'm aiming to really bring the Fergan podcast back with a bang. In conducting research for this, the information and the ideas just kept on expanding, and there is such a wealth of lore to get into. I actually wanted to look into non-Germanic attestations of giants, folklore that comes from outside of the Germanic lands, for example, the Celtic, the Titans of Hellenic lore. I wanted to look into all of that, but I don't think I'm going to have time to, and I wasn't able to research all of that fully. If we view mythology as purely something historical, then the lessons of that mythology, they could expire, or worse, we might fail to see the threat in the characters of those myths. If indeed we do view the giants of those myths as merely characters in old stories, then we may fail to see the threat that they pose to us and our way of life in these current times. So, giants. There are a few misconceptions, the main one being in the name giant. They're not all necessarily large. What we call giants were by our Germanic Norse ancestors called Jotnar, plural, or Jotun, singular. By the Anglo-Saxons, they were the Ettins. In Middle English, that's Ettins. The Norse also had the name Thurs, which I believe is also attested in Anglo-Saxon, but I'm not entirely sure about that. And most scholars believe that the what we know as trolls from Norse mythology are in fact the very same thing as the Thursar. So in our heathen lore, we generally consider dualism to be a thing of Christianity. This idea of good versus evil, of God versus Satan. In heathen lore, in paganism, we often, or I say we, but many often try to insinuate that we don't have dualism in paganism. I would actually push back against that, because at the heart of it, when you really look at the mythology, and when you really get to the heart of what our purpose is and what the purpose of the gods is, there is a clear duality. Order versus chaos. The Aesir and the Vanir against the Thursar. It's deeply embedded in our law and our belief system that we are upholding the good of our Innungard against the destructive forces from without. And of course, when it gets to the matter of Ragnarok, we have the most destructive wights, or Thursar, Jotnar. We have the most destructive of them trying to destroy the gods themselves. We have Fenrir swallowing the sun. The giants represent one side of a duality which is common. Of course, there are nuances, but you know, when viewed from a wide-angled lens, you do see some kind of duality in heathen lore, of which the giants are on one side. So we have famous giants. We have Mimir, of Mimir's Well. And Mimir is the council of Odin. So Mimir, straight away, we have a Jotun there who is benevolent, who is not just benevolent, but incredibly valuable to our most high god. Uther, or Weird, is a Jotun. Weird being one of the three sisters, the others being Verdandi and Skuld. We have half-giants, of course, in our pantheon. Odin, Loki, Thor, Hel, Fenrir, Jormungandr are all half-giant. And of course, any of the gods that descend from Odin are themselves part Jotun as well. And this is probably the biggest difficulty we have in getting to the heart of who or what the Jotnar are and what our reaction or relationship to them should be. So they live in Jotunheim and they all go to Jormungrens, that is the base of the world. They go to its most northern border to rest at night. Probably the most important thing to address when we're talking about the Jotnar, the giants, is that our very material, physical earth is made from the primeval giant, Ymir. Ymir arose from Gnungagap, from the yawning chaos. And Ymir gave birth. He had a son called Buri, who had a son called Bor, who married a giantess called Bestla, who was the daughter of Bulthorn. And Bulthorn, which means evil thorn, is believed by many to be another name for Ymir himself. So Ymir's own grandson married his own daughter, Bestla, and they gave birth to Odin, Vili, and Ve. So Odin, of course, Odin, Vili, and Ve, the first of the gods, they then slew Ymir. And I'll read a stanza from Grimnismal, which talks about the formation of the earth. This is from the Elder or Poetic Edda. From Ymir's flesh the earth was made, and from his blood the sea. Mountains from his bones, trees from his hair, and from his skull the sky. And from his eyelashes the cheerful gods made earth in the middle for men, and from his brain were the hard-tempered clouds all made. So Ymir, the name of whom means screamer, is the progenitor of the Hrimthursar, the rime giants, the frost giants, who I believe were formed from the sweat of Ymir's armpits. This is according to Snorri Sturluson in Gylfaginning. And Ymir's blood, according to Snorri, and this is Snorri's own interpretation, Ymir's blood drowned all the frost giants except for a giant or a jotun, or more specifically a thurs named Bergelmir. It's often said that the giants are forces of destruction, but here in this most important and foremost encounter or event in our creation history, we have Ymir, the first jotun, actually being used to create the very world in which we inhabit, far from destroying. It must be said that the world was created by Odin Viljan Ve from Ymir's body, rather than Ymir himself being the creator. At this point, it's worth mentioning that in Hindu record, in the Rig Veda, the giant named Purusha is sacrificed in a similar manner to Ymir. So one of the sources that I've used in my research, which I found particularly interesting in shedding light on all of this, is the website GermanicMythology.com, which I believe is mostly curated by William P. Reeves. And in one of the articles I read there, I found this particularly interesting segment goes as thus. This may be significant if we interpret Ymir as the first sacrifice, after which all subsequent sacrifices are patterned. The giants can then be seen as the sacrificial victims of the gods through decapitation. Thor typically slays his giant opponents by throwing his hammer against their heads. He is frequently said to crush their skulls. In Thor's Drapa, the giants are referred to as the cattle of Alfheim. What we have here is the idea that Ymir himself was the first sacrifice. In the same way that some heathens now will sacrifice an animal in their rituals, it could be said that the gods sacrificed a jotun for the benefit of themselves and further down the line for mankind. We have, you know, other examples of giants forming the physical landscape. You know, we have Jord as, or Fjörgin, or Fergin, as mentioned earlier, as the physical earth herself. We have the rime giants, or the Thursar, from Ymir's sweat. We have, in more recent folklore in Britain, we have the idea of standing stones being the teeth of giants, or having been thrown by giants, and that's why how they've ended up where they are. We have Hrungnir, who is one of the strongest giants, who was destroyed by Thor. And when Thor shattered Hrungnir in his stone form, it's said that he became the slate or the scree of the world. So it's deeply embedded in our oldest lore, and indeed in other Indo-European lore, that the giants themselves formed the physical aspects of this world in which we inhabit. But this idea of Ymir being the first sacrifice, I find particularly interesting, because if we view ourselves as being a level below the gods in terms of spiritual capability, or in terms of creative or magical capability, if we have different dimensions almost, and, you know, if you kind of imagine like layers on a cake, and we are at this lower level, and then you have the gods at a higher level, and we can't see them in the same three-dimensional physical way that we can see everything else in this world. Well, if we have cattle in our realm, which we are, or our ancestors have, certainly, sacrificed to please the gods, then do the gods themselves have a kind of cattle of their own to be sacrificed for the continuation of the cosmos? Well, if so, then Ymir and all who descend from Ymir, the other Jotnar, could be that source of sacrifice, that sacrificial pool from which they draw, in the same way that we might draw from cows or from goats, or indeed horses. That's very interesting to me, because it suggests, as you know, many heathen researchers or academics who are interested in heathenry have suggested is that the heathen sacrifice is a replication of the first sacrifice of Ymir. So we have this kind of mimicry going on here. And Thor kind of takes on this role as the head Goti who sacrifices the cattle of his realm, the Jotnar. Very interesting ideas indeed. So there we have one very core, important, vitally important aspect of the identity of the giants in their role as these entities which actually form the material realm which we inhabit. Another aspect that I'd like to discuss next is this idea of the giants being symbols or aspects of nature. In the same way that some detractors of paganism might say that the gods are merely symbolic of, you know, the wind, of storms, of the sun, of other aspects of nature, there is this idea also with the giants themselves. We have one of the most famous tales involving Thor and the gods is the journey of Thor with Loki and Thialfi to Utgarda-Loki. So many of you will be familiar with this story. It's a story wherein Thor journeys with Loki, who is usually his arch nemesis, and also with Thialfi to the land of the giants to visit a giant called Utgarda-Loki. Now, there seems to be some confusion among those who've researched this. I'm reluctant to call them academics because not everyone who researches Norse lore is an academic or would like to be called one. But there is some confusion about the idea that Loki is traveling to visit Utgarda-Loki, who seems to potentially be the same being, rather than there being some kind of difference because of the names. But anyway, inconsistencies aside, Thor, Loki, and Thialfi are challenged by giants to contests in that realm. Loki competes in an eating contest, only to find out that he's been competing against a Logi, which is fire itself. Thialfi competes in a contest of speed, only to discover that the giant that he is competing against is Thought itself, which of course is faster than anyone can possibly run. So in this tale, we have very much the idea of giants being personifications of nature. So it is present in the lore, this idea. So moving on, there's another idea that I think we have to consider is one that's of a less metaphysical, less spiritual bent, which is that the giants may simply represent a dynasty or race of beings earlier than the arrival of the Aesir and Vanir. I mean, that theory, of course, falls flat on its face from the get-go because Odin is one of the gods that is born from one of the very first Jotun. So if that were indeed the case, then it would suggest that Odin himself, to a large extent, belongs to this earlier race, as opposed to belonging to the Aesir. However, we do have in Gylfaginning, and please forgive my mispronunciation of Norse, old Norse Icelandic words here, but in Gylfaginning, we have, it is said that Norfi, or Nurfi or Narfi, is the name of a giant that dwelt in Jotunheim. He had a daughter called Night. She was swarthy and dark, as befitted her race. So we have there, in Snorri's Prose Edda, the idea that the physical appearance of a Jotun designated or was symbolic of their origin, of their race, which suggests, indeed, a racial aspect to the Jotnar. The idea that they are physical genetic beings who may have a different racial or species origin to the gods. I think we also can't completely discount the idea that in prehistoric times that we have no record of whatsoever, there may have been other entities, other species that have become extinct long ago. Perhaps there were large entities, strong, large entities who had different values to those of our Indo-European ancestors. And perhaps they were seen as giants. And perhaps many of the tales that we have are muddled rememberings of this long forgotten, long extinct race or species upon this earth. Of course, this is very speculative and some may scoff at the idea of that, but I don't think it's something that we can completely discount as being possible. Another aspect of the Jotnar is the idea that they represent the characteristics or emotions that we are familiar with as human beings. For example, an old kenning for passion is the wind of giantesses or of troll women. So it's saying that when someone feels passion, they're experiencing the wind of a giantess. It's the idea that passion itself comes, or it originates with giants, that they are the source of these powerful emotions. The giant Vafthrûthnir means mighty entangler. So Vafthrûthnir is a confuser who Thor battles against. And if we look at Thor, who is, of course, our patron in terms of the war against the Jotuns, the Jotnar, Thor brings clarity with his thunder and lightning. He's decisive with his hammer. So in this sense, Thor represents a quickness of mind. He represents definitive action. He represents clarity. He represents definition, as opposed to the confusion and the entanglement and the chaos and the murkiness that seems to accompany the character of the Jotnar. So, moving on from that, are the Jotnar a threat to mankind? Well, we have in the poem from the Elder Edda, Harbardshlod, "I travelled east and killed giants, their ill-working women. Who went to the mountain, there would be many more giants. If they were all alive, there would be no men left in Midgard. What did you, Harbard, do meanwhile?" So here we have Thor proclaiming that if he were not there to threaten and to kill giants, then there would be firstly many more of them, and that there would also be no men left in Midgard, because this is how much of a threat that they pose to mankind. So in this single verse, we have proof of Thor's dedication to the protection of mankind. And it's easy to see after reading that why so many of our ancestors wore a Mjolnir or hammer around their necks, and why so many of us do now. In terms of our day-to-day well-being and protection, there really is no more important a god than Thor in that. And we summon him by wearing his totem amulet, the hammer. Then we have a recent English folklore. And I do think that it's important to look into some of this. And in a future episode, I think I'll be gathering more of this kind of thing when I also look into Celtic lore regarding giants and things like that. We have Jack and the Beanstalk, of course, which is the story of Jack, a boy who, using a magic bean, grows an immense beanstalk, climbs to the top of it, and finds himself in the hall of a giant. He steals from the giant. It's evidently this giant is hoarding treasures in his great hall. And when the giant discovers that his treasure has been stolen, he says the famous line, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread." And this is perfectly in fitting with the idea of the Ayrtons. Now, Ayrton has the etymological meaning of to consume, to eat. It's related to our modern word to eat. And I believe that Jotun has a similar etymological origin. So fundamentally, the Jotnar, the Ettins, they are consumers, they are eaters. And in this poem, we see that they may well be consumers of men. They may be seeking to actually consume men. And could this therefore be the reason for Thor's dedication towards the protection of Midgard and mankind? So, yeah, they're a threat to mankind. They're a threat to Midgard. They're a threat to Asgard, the home of the gods. And, of course, the most famous progenitor of the most terrible of Jotnar is Loki himself. Like Odin, he is half Asir, half Jotun. And Loki generally represents or is a force of obstruction, of disorder, of deception, and of chaos. And Loki is the sire of the worst wights that we know of in our lore. Fenrir, of Jormungandr. So there really are no worse examples of the threat posed by the Jotnar to not just mankind, but to the gods, to the Asir, than Loki's children. Loki is said to be so destructive, to cause such problems, that he's eventually bound beneath the earth, where he is said to cause earthquakes. So even when bound, he causes great destruction upon Midgard. Fenrir, the wolf, child of Loki, is the father of Skurl and Hati, the wolves who chase the sun and the moon across the sky. And of course, Fenrir causes Ragnarok by consuming Odin, whilst his children, Skurl and Hati, consume the sun and the moon. And going back to the tale of Jack and the Beanstalk, we have the idea of giants as being hoarders of treasure, in the same way that Smaug, the great dragon from The Hobbit, hoards treasure. And on that note, I think we can generally consider many of the dragons or worms to be other examples of the Jotnar, of the giants. Because when we look at myths like Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, and when we look at St. George slaying the dragon, these seem to be echoes or at least similar to the idea of Thor, who slays these great beasts as well. So these dragons seem to me to be also among the giant species. I said at the beginning of this podcast that I wouldn't have time to explore other non-Germanic mythologies regarding giants. However, there are a couple which I feel are particularly important to mention during this first exploration of the subject of giants. And the first of those is Zoroastrianism. And I'll just read a segment which I rather lazily took from Wikipedia, but which I think gives a very good overview and introduction to an idea that I'd like to present here, which is this. In the Gathas, the oldest texts of the Zoroastrian canon, the Devas are gods that are to be rejected. This meaning is subject to interpretation, perhaps also evident in the old Persian Deva inscription of the 5th century BCE. In the younger Avesta, the Devas are divinities that promote chaos and disorder. In later tradition and folklore, the Dews, Zoroastrian Middle Persian, New Persian Divs, are personifications of every imaginable evil. So we have here in a rather ancient tradition, because in Zoroastrianism, you have, which is a very dualistic religion, very dualistic tradition, in which you have the great benevolent creator god Ahura Mazda and his opponent Ahriman. And then below Ahriman, you have the Devas, who are supposedly the gods that are to be rejected, who are the personifications of every imaginable evil. Now, one of the reasons that I've been so interested to look at who or what the giants are in our Indo-European lore is because in all other traditions, in biblical lore, in Zoroastrian, in Vedic, in the various animistic religions of the world too, you have these troublesome, problematic spirits, whether they be called demons or devils or devas. And the closest we have in our Germanic heathen lore is the Jotnar. So I think it's interesting to look at these other traditions to see what they say about these problematic spirits and how they view them, because this can shed some light on our own interpretation of the Jotnar. Now, a big other tradition that I'd like to compare and get into here is Gnosticism. Now, those of you who've been following the Fergan for a long time and who listened to the first 33 episodes of the podcast, I believe it was in episode 8, I think it was, that I interviewed and spoke with the Gnostic scholar John Lamb Lash, who I have great respect and admiration for. I highly value and recommend his book, Not in His Image, because I think there are some important and significant crossovers between his interpretation of Gnosticism and our pagan lore. And one of the most important crossovers, I think, or potential crossovers, is the Gnostic concept of the Archons. Now, the Archons, I think, are probably the most interesting and significant aspect of John Lash's interpretation of Gnosticism, particularly in trying to work out how to solve many of the problems that we face. What is it that is causing the madness among modern man? And John draws his interpretation of Gnosticism from the Nag Hammadi Library, which is a great collection of Gnostic texts which were discovered in Nag Hammadi in Egypt in, I believe, 1947. And in those texts, there is a passage which reads as follows: "Behold, I shall reveal to you the path of deliverance. Whenever you are seized in the soul and undergo mortal fear, a multitude of archons may turn on you, thinking they can capture you. And in particular, three of them will seize you, those who pose as toll collectors. Not only do they demand toll, but they take away souls by theft." Now, I just want to read some segments, some quotes from an article that John Lash wrote about the Archons and their nature, or anti-nature, I should say. And I'll comment on these in turn. So John has written, "For one thing, Gnostics asserted that the paternal father God of Jews and Christians alike, Yahweh Jehovah, was in reality one of the Archons, an alien intruder, a hostile ET. And moreover, they insisted that this alien pretender is insane and working against humanity." So here we have a clear similarity between the Archons and the Jotnar. But not only that, if we're to follow John's line of thinking that Jehovah, the Abrahamic God himself, is an Archon, is the Grand Archon, and we are saying that the Archons could be the Jotnar of Gnostic lore, then that means that Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, is himself a Jotun, a giant. These entities who are of a different type, of a different origin, who are working against the well-being of humanity, who are hostile indeed to humanity. John also writes, "Several texts in the Nag Hammadi Library warn explicitly that Archons envy humanity for the qualities of freedom and love, not to mention ingenuity and imagination, all of which they lack. These texts state that the envious ETs operate through deception and excel in simulation, but basically have no agenda or master plan except to disrupt and confuse." This goes to the idea that they can't actually create anything. And here I would look back to the origin myth of Ymir, who himself came into being, but did not create the earth, but rather was used to create the earth by the gods, the Asir, Odin, Vili, and Ve. So do we have another comparison there? These entities, they cannot create, but they can become part of our existence nevertheless. John goes on, Gnostics saw the threat operating along two trajectories, by psychic intrusion, or mental parasitism, and by deviant and insane beliefs framed in religious ideology. So, going back to the previous topic we discussed, the idea of the Jotnar being a very psychological thing, of representing or embodying emotions and feelings or thoughts within the mind, such as that of passion. Do they work rather than in a physical sense? Do these entities work upon us? Do they work against us by psychic intrusion, as John said, by instilling within us insane beliefs, such as Abrahamism, the Abrahamic religions, which are not native or natural to us? Is this the legacy of the Archons? And could it be the legacy of the Thursar, the malevolent Jotnar? John also wrote, "They would have us destroy the home planet out of sheer envy against us," Gnostics cautioned. So again, we have the idea, as Thor said, that the Jotnar, the giants, would destroy Midgard and all of mankind. John, and his interpretation of Gnosticism, says that the Archons of Gnostic lore would destroy our planet out of sheer envy against us. Envy meaning that we have something that they want, and if they can't have it, then they don't want us to have it either. John continues, "In Gnostic cosmology, the Earth does not properly belong to the celestial clockworks of the solar system, but is merely captured in it, an organic planet captured in an inorganic system." Now this got me thinking, if our Earth is indeed an organic thing, populated with organic beings, and yet the Archons are themselves inorganic, well, that doesn't accurately match the story of Ymir and the Earth being created from Ymir's body. However, if we slightly adjust that quote to say that, or to suggest that, the Jotnar may be comprised of organic material but without spirit and without intention. So in a sense, they are inorganic in their lack of spirit, spirit being the animating force, then that starts to make sense. Perhaps this also makes sense of the fact that our gods, the Asir and some of the Vanir, are part Jotun. Perhaps what that really means is that they are genetically of the same stock, but that the Jotnar from which they descend do not possess the same animating spirit that the gods and man possess. So that's an interesting idea, that perhaps the fundamental distinction between god and giant is that the gods possess spirit, whereas the giants do not. John also says, "Their main tactics are mental error, in brackets intellectual virus or false ideology, especially religious doctrines, and simulation." So this kind of neatly dovetails into another possible theory or explanation for the nature of the Jotnar, which is that they are not genetically, materially, any one specific thing. They're not distinguished by their species, but rather distinguished by their character, by their motivation, by their intention. Could it be that, for example, an entity could be a Jotun one day and an Asir the next day by virtue of a change of intention or a change of spirit or a change of character? Maybe to call someone or something a Jotun could be to, you know, it could be akin to calling someone, you know, a cantankerous man, or an unscrupulous man, or a selfish man. But then if that man were to change his ways, then he is no longer a Jotun. And I know that this is very speculative, because we don't have, as far as I know, any examples in the lore of the same being being called both a Jotun and or an a Thurs or a troll, as well as something else at another point in time. But perhaps there is an inbuilt intention within all of us, a soul or a spirit or a character that we are bestowed with. And it's that character which determines what we actually are, whether we are a man or whether we are in fact something else. And perhaps the equivalent of that among the gods is that those who are not good, those who do not work for the benefit of the order and creation and bliss and frith of the cosmos, are actually working towards something different and are thus designated as being Jotnar or Thursar. So we're coming to the end of this particular episode's exploration of who or what the Jotnar are. But I think, you know, and I've deliberately left this till last because I think this is the defining aspect or the defining characteristics of the Jotnar is that they are diverse, that they have no definitive characteristic. We can see that they are not simply agents of destruction, because the very cosmos that we live within was comprised of the body of Jotnar. So destruction, although some Jotnar might be destructive, and perhaps those who are destructive are differentiated from the less destructive ones by being called Thursar as opposed to Jotnar. Although I've come to doubt that, because Jotnar itself also means consumers. So whether they are a Hrimthurs, a frost giant, or whether they are a Jotnar, a consumer, that seems to suggest a negative connotation each way. However, we must remember that one of the first and foremost and most important of the Jotnar is Mimir. Mimir being counsel to Odin, and his name being etymologically related to mind or memory. Mimir is a Jotun and is the son of Ymir, who is Bulthorn, the evil thorn. So there we have an example of a Jotun who is, by all accounts, an incredibly positive, wise entity, yet is part of this so-called negative race of beings and is the son of evil Thorn himself. We also, on the other hand, we have Mischief Mimir being a kenning for Jotun. So this is a confusing one, because Mimir himself is a Jotun, yet a Mischief Mimir is a Jotun. So what really does that make Mimir? He is born, he is of the same family tree. He is descended from Ymir, the primeval Jotun. Yet he is distinguished from other Jotun by the fact that other Jotun are called Mischief Mimirs, and Mimir himself is not known to be mischievous. In my research, I came across a very interesting passage by a medievalist named Margaret Clunies Ross, who I'm not familiar with, but she wrote, "Characteristically, the gods covet important natural resources which the giants own, then steal them and turn them to their own advantage by utilizing them to create culture. That is, they put the giants' raw materials to work for themselves. These raw materials are of diverse kinds and include intellectual capital, such as the ability to brew ale, as well as the cauldron in which it is made, and abstractions made concrete, like the mead of poetry and the runes of wisdom." So there she's talking about the mead of poetry, which was in the possession of Suttunga and is stolen or must be stolen. And this led to some speculation on my part that perhaps when we're dealing with the Jotnar, what we're really dealing with is matter that is unordered, matter that is not yet put to proper use or to the betterment of the order and goodness of the cosmos. And perhaps it is the ordering divine intention and spirit of the Æsir and Vanir, and of man, which is to take that unordered matter, such as when Odin Viljanve took the matter of Ymir and turned it into something ordered, something beautiful. And perhaps when Thor is fighting the Jotnar, what he is really doing is sacrificing them for order, turning them into something meaningful to the lives and existence of the Æsir and of man. So perhaps they do represent chaos in that sense, but not incorporeal chaos, not a metaphysical, immaterial chaos, but kind of a chaos of matter, a matter which is not yet put to its proper use. And in this quote from Margaret Clunies Ross, she talks about the gods taking from the giants, stealing from them things which enable the creation of culture, which is then shared with mankind. So this material is actually born of the Jotnar, in some cases, such as the cauldron, which she speaks of. It's created by the Jotnar, but is then taken and put to proper use by the gods. So, in conclusion, the giants are an enigmatic topic for us to deal with. They can't easily be pigeonholed and explained away as something specific. That said, they clearly do represent one part of a dichotomy, of a duality, in which our gods that we worship, that we hold to, that we remain true to, and of our human kin that we care for and that we protect, the giants are broadly said to be in opposition to that, to be a threat to that, even though in the origin of the cosmos, giants were used in the creation, specifically the most primeval original of giants, Ymir, was used for the creation of this wonderful cosmos. But I think the important thing to take away from that cosmology is the fact that Ymir himself did not create the cosmos. Rather, the cosmos was created by the Æsir from the flesh, from the matter of Ymir. So Ymir himself, even Ymir, who could be said to be the most creative of the Jotnar by virtue of being the very building blocks of the cosmos, even he is not necessarily to be taken as benevolent, because there was no intention by him to create this cosmos. What makes things more complicated is that we seem to have a differentiation, a contrast between Jotnar and Thursar. The Hrimthursar seem to be of a particularly dangerous breed. And of course, we have the worst monsters of all in Loki's children, particularly of Fenrir, who marks the death of the Allfather, and Loki himself, who causes mischief and chaos at every turn. A friend of mine, who some of you may be aware of, who is named Saxon Corkhill Philpott, and also goes by the name the Chad Pastoralist, in a private conversation, he had some interesting thoughts to share on this, and he used a very interesting analogy. He suggested that Fenrir is symbolic of mankind's flaws, of our base instincts, and all that is the antithesis of everything divine. He shared the analogy that Midgard is like a garden bed of vegetables, with the soil and vegetables are the life and all that is good, while the border around the soil is like the boundary of Midgard, and that the weeds that are constantly trying to grow and push through the cracks, push through the soil, are like the Ettins or the Jotnar, who are consuming and bringing chaos, not chaos, but undoing the fine work of the gardener. And if we're to see our gods as the gardeners, of the protectors of that realm, of that garden, of that flower bed, of that vegetable bed, then the Jotnar, the giants that are pushing through like weeds, need to constantly be dealt with in some sort of way. And I suppose, just as how a weed has no intention to ruin your garden, perhaps a Jotun has no conscious intention of ruining Midgard, and yet still needs to be defended against, as Thor does. Saxon also said that objective truth and goodness can be tended in that garden. So perhaps within our Innengard, where within the place where our folk dwell, there can be such a thing as objective good that may not exist outside of that garden. Things which don't necessarily benefit us, like, for example, compassion towards animals and other humans that don't have an necessarily always have a direct benefit to us, but they are principles, values, which can be nurtured within that realm, and that the Jotnar may be seeking to undo that, to spoil our good nature. And that kind of ties in all of these different theories together. The idea that the Jotnar are a force, a psychological force upon our minds. Well, we need to protect against those base thoughts which might lead us to do ignoble things, and that they are attacking us and need to be defended. We need to be defended from them, which could be symbolic or symbolized by Thor and his protection of Midgard. I now realize that this study, this research, this topic is going to be an ongoing one, and that as much as I'm trying to share information and knowledge and ideas with all of you, it's a learning experience for myself as well. So I do think that there will be further episodes on this in the future, because there's an awful lot more that I can get into. But one thing that I know for sure is that we are supposed to hallow ourselves and our immediate surroundings against the Jotnar, against the threats of evil wights. In most Odinist or heathen groups, there is a hallowing of the circle, a hallowing of the space that begins before every ritual. And this is important to do. So I wanted to share something that I've developed in over the last few weeks. I believe that our ancestors would have sung their rituals more so than spoken them. And I wanted to develop a short, concise, yet powerful ritual that I could perform each morning to protect myself and my loved ones against the predations or the influence of these evil sometimes, chaotic sometimes, destructive sometimes, ignorant sometimes, or perhaps unconscious wights or archons, if we're to go by Gnostic lore. So I composed a short song, and every morning I walk to some nearby woodland, and I face in the four cardinal directions, and I sing the song whilst holding my hammer, the hammer that's around my neck. And I sing the song, and then I meditate for a few minutes, and I harness the flow and the power of Vril or Chi or etheric energy. So I'm going to share with you the song that I sing, and maybe some of you might choose to adopt the song or adapt the song or do something similar yourself. So here it is. Great Thun, I'll lend us your might to ward off evil wights, and bring to their doom those who consume, banish their bile and their blight. So there you have it. Before I end this monologue, I'd like to give credit to the primary sources used in the research for this episode. www.germanicmythology.com, the YouTube channel Fortress of Lu, and New Dawn magazine, which features some of the articles by John Lamlash on the Archons. Those have proved invaluable in putting forth some of the ideas that I intended to get across in this episode. So thank you all for listening to this first in the return series of the Fergan podcast. Stay with us here on Hearthfire Radio as we grow and develop and add excellent new podcasts to the repertoire. And I believe this could be and will be an extremely powerful, insightful, and valuable platform and tool for Folkish Heathens. So help it to grow, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of the Fergan Podcast.